welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. Joining me this week is George Kennedy.
Good evening.
And the illustrious Stephen J. Ewing.
It is I.
There's no, like, third or junior or, like, the first?
No. I mean, you can put an Esquire after it if you'd like, but no, there's no...
I'm a third.
You're a third?
Yes.
Yes, of course. It fits. Well, anyway, the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by the Tire Rack, the leading online source for tires and much more, such as wheels, wheel covers, windshield wipers, engine and brake fluids, lighting, and more. You can shop Tire Rack at TireRack.com. We're going to have them on very soon to talk about all kinds of awesome stuff that you can get from them that are actually not tires, like brakes and suspension upgrades and stuff like that, especially for Christmas coming up. But let's head to the Autoblog garage, and we'll start with the Autoblog fleet manager, because you always save the best for yourself. What are you driving, Steve?
This is a week of that, but I do have the 2013 Audi S5 Coupe right now, which so there's good and bad for 2013. The good is the car got a very slight cosmetic refresh. The new headlights are really attractive. There's a couple of new color options, a couple of new wheel options. It's like they just made that car look just ever so slightly better. The bad news is you can't get that awesome 4.2 liter V8 anymore.
Yeah.
Which is...
Ooh. Apparently, the police agree.
I'm sorry. I live on the busiest street in Detroit.
All you have to say is you live in Detroit. It's okay. It's fine.
Yeah, and I have the hospital complex two blocks behind me, so I don't hear the sirens, but I'm glad you do.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I have the 2013 Audi S5, and it's got the 3-liter supercharged V6 that they still insist on calling a 3.0T for some reason. You know, 333 horsepower, 325 pound-feet of torque. It's only a little bit less powerful than the old 4.2 V8, but it doesn't have the sound. You can't rev it as high. It's just not as engaging of an engine.
But it's torqueier, you know? Right?
It is. Well, the torque number is actually the same. The difference is the torque is delivered at a lower RPM now. So you have more low-end grunt, but there's... I wrote this down. There's 21 fewer horsepower now. So when you are sort of near the top end, the throttle response isn't as good. It's harder to keep that car like ready and raring to go. You've got to really work at it now. The gain though is fuel economy has improved.
Hello?
Whoa. That's pretty badass. The fuel economy has improved to the point where Stephen J. Ewing has gone into epileptic seizures. Right, we'll just carry on then, and we'll pick him back up later.
I was going to say, can you get that that 4.2 on the RS5?
I don't know what you can get in the RS5. All I know is that Audi's coming back with like diesels galore, so I'd be shocked if they actually had an S5 diesel, but, you know... they're putting diesels in like everything else. He's right. Still not working. Steve, yeah. What's going on? Anyway, let's move on to what you're driving, George.
Yes, I'm driving the new 2013 Ford Escape.
Speaking of another vehicle, is it turbocharged? Is it the EcoBoost?
It is, yes. It's the EcoBoost. So this is the fully loaded titanium, four-wheel drive, at the turbocharged inline four, which is really, like, it's... It's sort of. I'm still getting my brain around the whole notion of your top feature engine being a turbocharged, smaller displacement engine over like a naturally aspirated V6. Like, you know, for the last ever, your high feature engine was like a V8 or V6. So there's a different feel to that power delivery compared to, you know.
Driving. Yeah, it's like gritty and buzzy and.
Yeah, but that's the way of the future. So you're gonna have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly. It's not that bad, and if the EcoBoost is pretty well behaved, and the V6 that was in the Escape, the previous gen, you know, there was a 3-liter that they gave a bunch of tweaks to. It wasn't that bad, but it was also kind of gritty and not exactly wonderful.
Right, and it's, you know, you don't even really notice that compared to the fact that this is just overall really nice crossover. I mean, they pretty much built... A CRV,
except for okay. What trim level is it again?
Titanium.
Yeah, so it's a $45,000 CRV.
It is a No. It is a $36,000.
$36,000.
Yeah.
Good for you, Ford. Good for you.
Somebody will buy it too. I mean, look, here's the thing. It's got, you know, a ton of goodies in it. It's got the My Ford Touch, which I think is getting there. The one thing I didn't like about the nav system was that there is still this like half second delay. So when you're entering like, you know, an address into the nav system, you can't get the, you know, you're typing in, you know, Maple Lane and you try to hit M then A. It takes a half second while it's thinking to try and narrow down the amount of streets that that might be.
See, I'm not sure that I actually like that whole idea of it, like, automatically telling me what street I'm trying
to...
No, it's not
bringing up a queue. It's more just, like, thinking on the back end and sort of narrowing down letters and whatnot.
So, Steven's back.
I'm back. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's fine. We're talking about the Ford Escape Titanium that that George has.
Is it $37,000?
Oh, you are very close.
Oh, $36,800.
You still would have won the showcase prize.
Other way? Oh no.
36,025.
Okay.
That's right. I mean, you know, honestly, there is no Mercury anymore. So there's sort of there is a space for that kind of price point. I think people are gonna have a little bit of getting used to in terms of a Ford compact crossover priced up around there, but you don't have to buy the Titanium. You can buy an SE or an SEL.
No, you don't. And the lower trims are very nice. You know, we just did that comparison test about a month ago where we used an Escape and a CX-5, and the Escape that we had was like $26,000-$27,000, and it was just an SE front-wheel drive. It was very nicely equipped still.
Yeah, and what's nice too is like they handle really nicely. Everything that's you know, that Ford is doing on, you know, those platforms and lower. Like, I was just at the C-Max drive last week. Everything along those sides, it's tight handling feel, and it's just real fun on the highway.
So yours has all-wheel drive, correct?
Yes, which they're calling four-wheel drive.
Right. See, the thing is, you know, when I drove the Escape not long ago, a bunch of us actually all noted the fact that the steering, you know, Ford's done a lot of really good stuff with electronic power steering recently, but in the Escape it just felt so twitchy and so like over boosted that it was almost like it just didn't feel safe to be using. Like if you put even too much effort into that turn, the car was just gone to one direction. It was really weird, like totally hard to get used to as well.
I don't know, I didn't notice that too much.
It could have just been a lot of, you know, like the other problems we had with it were that it torque steered like crazy, but again, that's just a front wheel drive thing. So yeah,
you would think that with the new E-Pass system, one of the things they talk about is how it can adjust for things like torque steer and road crown more right. than other systems. Apparently, can't work miracles of physics.
There's, you know, quite a bit of torque steer in the Escape. I shouldn't say quite a bit. There's more than you would ever expect in a crossover, and I think that might throw some people off.
Was yours? No, it was an SE, but did it? What powertrain did it have?
It was the 1.6 EcoBoost.
Okay, so that's probably why. I mean, a Turbo 4 has a lot of torque down low, especially the EcoBoost that's tuned to sort of have its torque plateau. So there's not much you can do with that if you're just sending it all through the front wheels. It's going to torque steer.
I hear you. It's just, I don't know. I didn't love the way that one drove, but to the point of George's car, I did drive a 2-liter Titanium when the car first launched, and I thought it was really good.
So, in terms of like the segment, though, do you think that this is the CRV always sort of wins the segment in a lot of ways? Do you think that this is sort of ultra competitive in that top end of the segment?
I'd say it probably will be. The one knock on it that would have is that the ride, you know, the trade off for that responsive handling is that the ride is kind of rough. And I haven't been in a CRV in a while, so
the ride is good.
Yeah, so they're gonna have a hard time, you know.
Yeah, it's certainly a harsher ride in the Escape, and I think the Escape is absolutely top of the class, but it still feels a little cramped inside to me. Some of the materials aren't really good. Like, the CRV and the Escape are both really solid purchases, and I think that the Escape has more of an emotional attachment. The CRV is just sort of, you know, I need the crossover.
Well, they're both sort of okay. So the CRV is a Civic wagon. The Escape is a Focus wagon, and
right.
You know, so both of those are sort of underlying goodness in different ways. I do agree with you that the Escape sort of has more verve, which is really strange to say given where Honda's come from. But yeah, again, I think that those are sort of the two that are duking it out for the top honors. And
well, the CX-5 is up there too now.
Well, the CX-5 is really entertaining to drive, but mm-hmm. there's no way I would get in a CRV and after being in a CX-5 and not go, wow, this is smoother and quieter and a lot nicer, and it is. You know.
It is all those things, but I still think that the CX-5 offers a lot of good charm and a lot of good price point. Good, I mean, the interior is nice, but it's not up to par of the tech with even Honda or Ford. I think it looks good. I think it drives really well, but I don't know. The CR-V doesn't do anything for me, but in the same way that, like, the Accord is good, but it doesn't do anything for me either.
Yes,
right,
yeah.
But for your average buyer, like, you know, there's no.
Oh no, I absolutely
brand cachet
agree,
for the CX-5. You know, there's going to be a sure. lot of equity to trade on for the Escape and the CR-V.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the CR-V is the one to beat. It has it locked up in the ways that it's a very rational purchase. It's also, you know, if you're not a driving enthusiast, I mean, it's just a solid vehicle, and it does a lot of things really well, and it's a family vehicle. It's very good. It's very well thought out. The CX-5 was delightful to drive. We actually took that on vacation up into the White Mountains up in New Hampshire, so I got to drive that across one of the passes, and it handles really well. It had a manual, which was tremendously entertaining for me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that that's sort of the driver's choice. And in other respects, it loses out to the Escape and the CR-V. And I think the Escape has come quite far from this charming little trucklet thing to, a much more refined player that actually is going to attract buyers that aren't sort of giant gas company fleets or something.
Well, right. And the one place that the Escape will improve upon, like, for, you know, say it's mid-cycle refresh, is that right now it has kind of a busy design inside and out. And if you look at the C-Max and the Fusion, they're cleaning up that design. So whenever it goes in for a mid-cycle refresh in 2 years, 3 years, it's going to get that cleaner design. And I think it's going to be a huge jump in terms of, you know, what that does for its attractiveness.
But even then, the exterior isn't what bothers me on that car. I think the CX-5 is a very, very handsome crossover. It's just the interior. It's, you know, that whole front section just feels so cramped and so clustered together, even with the MyFord touchscreen, which doesn't have as many buttons on it. You know, but it all just feels so, like, there's way too much going on.
It's very busy, yes.
And that's recent small Ford, though. I mean, the Fiesta's the same way. The Focus is
the same way, too.
But they just tweaked the Fiesta to clean it up a little bit. I haven't seen interior shots, but if you look at, you know, the next Fiesta, the exterior, right, it's more in line with the Fusion and cleaner design. Mm-hmm.
But again, that's not the thing I think people have issue with. I don't look at the Escape and go, wow, there's a lot going on. I think it's probably the most attractive crossover in that segment, honestly.
Yeah, and what's really cool too is, like, I was walking to the car from parking it, you know, down the street, and when you're walking up on it, it has a really, like, sporty, aggressive stance. And I know that's, like, a very, you know, generic way of describing it, but, like, they've stanced the car in such a way where it, you know, it looks ready to, like, pounce.
It does look good. Yeah, it's got a good street presence. I agree.
Well, all right. So we should get back to actually the question that George asked about your Audi. We're going to jump around a little bit. He wants to know if you can get the 4.2 and the RS5.
Yeah, the RS5 does have the 4.2.
Which you'd have to drop like 70 grand for, right?
Yeah, it's a bit more money.
Kind of worth it, though.
It's absolutely kind of worth it because so the S5 that I had, price as tested was $66,570, which 66 grand buys you a really nice M3.
A pair of Ford Escapes.
Or a pair of Ford Escapes. But the M3 is quicker. It's lighter. It makes more power. It makes a better noise. It's sharper.
Wait, which M3 makes a better noise?
And it's an M3.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, that the V8 M3 I agree with. I'm not sure I'm enamored of the noise of the six-cylinder M3, which I realize is heresy.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like current. You go to a lot and buy a brand new M3, you're getting that 4.4 V8.
Also, I'd rather have a rear drive M3 versus, you know, Quattro's nice, but
see, Quattro's really good, and the overall dynamics of the S5 are really impressive. I mean, the way it puts its power to the road, and the steering, the suspension, the brakes, all of that, it's all very, very good. It's just not as like razor sharp as an M3, but in turn, I think that the S5 is more of the car that you could easily drive every day and have a very good time.
Right, and that's where I come at it. I realize I'm the resident old guy, but I like the sort of livability of the Audis versus the BMWs, and that's not just the M versus S cars. I think it's just overall, and I think the Audis are a better value.
I agree, too. And I mean, if you look at the S5 and you look at an M3, the M3 looks very powerful, and it looks very aggressive, and it looks like it needs to go to a track right now. But the S5 is very, very, very clean, very simple, good lines. It all flows together very nicely. It's a very elegant car.
It looks like a grown-up sport.
Maybe that's what it is, me being the grown-up. Well, I'm not. But
I love that A5 S5 RS5 design. It's like the last like real Coke bottle to it, the way that the, you know, the front rear fenders move to each other. So it really is a, you know, gorgeous car.
It's a really pretty car, and the one I had, I have a quick spin of it going up later in the week. The car that I had was that new Estoril blue color that Audi is doing, which is one of my new favorite colors. It's just gorgeous, especially on the coupe.
And now,
super, super pretty.
Ooh, I just looked that up. Yeah, it's real nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ustream wants to know if you felt any torque steer on the S5.
No.
Yeah,
No.
Yeah,
Car with the Quattro, and the fact that, I mean, it's a rear bias Quattro system in that car to begin with. And especially when you're hard on it, it's sending most of its power to the back.
Yeah, and you know, like my thought with Audis is, oh, they're front wheel drive biased. They got all that weight in the nose. You know what? It doesn't matter. They managed to sort of outsmart what you'd think it would be for a front wheel drive based car, and they just drive so well.
Mm-hmm. So, well, no, they're rear drive based now. It's actually like 60/40 rear.
Right, but I mean they've got like a front drive setup where they've got lots of weight in the nose, way out of in front of the axle.
Right, it's true. I mean, but the fact that the Quattro manages that power so well, it feels really balanced, and there's no torque steer. You know, the front end, it doesn't wash out in a corner. There's no understeer. It's really nicely done.
Now, was it a manual?
It was a manual.
Oh, you lucky bastard.
It was a manual, which I mean, I love the manual in this car. The only problem is the clutch. Maybe it's just because I have short legs like Dan. But I'm just assuming you have short legs. But
that'll pass.
It's fine. The actual like length of the travel of the clutch in this car, it's a little too long. And because of that, I find that I have to sit like closer to the dash than I would like to, just in order to be able to actually push in the clutch pedal all the way.
So you get like the grandma posture when you're driving?
You kind of do. And then because I sit with the seat back, like sort of upright, I like to have that good commanding presence, you know, the nice bend in my elbows when I'm at 9 and 3 and all that. But I still feel like I'm sitting really close. And actually a friend of mine got in the car and commented on that. They're like, wow, you sit really close in this. I'm like, I have to, so I can push the clutch in all the way. Otherwise I can't reach because I have, you know, these like tiny legs.
You have like T-Rex.
Ah, you short people and your short problems.
Yeah, you know, I don't tend to have the problem.
Nothing of these things.
Am I taller than you?
I've never met you in person. I think I'm 5'6". So
okay, I'm 5'7".
Okay, so you're an inch taller than me. Maybe it's all in your torso, Steve. I don't know. Maybe I have longer legs than you.
That's possible.
You know, Steve's right though, because I'm 6'3", and when I get in a car with a manual, I make sure I sit far closer than I would, and not far closer, but a few inches closer than I would in an automatic, because I want to have my legs in the ideal position to shift.
Well, generally, most people don't sit close enough to the wheel. A lot of people slouch. The test is you take your one of your arms, left or right, and you want the top of the steering wheel, when you extend your arm, to sit right at your wrist.
Yep, and that's with your shoulders against the seat.
Against the seat back.
You're not leaning forward at all to do it.
Right. You want it.
We should have Dan do a series of how-to videos like this, and like how to properly set your like side and rear view mirrors and you know.
Yeah, well, to set the side mirrors, you lean over like to the right and you adjust them. There's
see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, because like, and that's, we'll touch on this later.
But no, that's my exact seating position, and I've always had this problem, not just with the, you know, the A5 and S5 too, but with a lot of Audi and Volkswagen models. I just had a GTI recently where it was the same thing, where I feel like I have to sit a lot closer than I would like to, just because the travel on the clutch is so deep, you know, into the footwell.
Well, the Germans would just stretch your leg out. That's all. I mean, they'd just be like, oh, the problem's not the car. The problem's you, clearly. You need to hang a 10-pound weight from your feet when you sleep.
Or they would just tell me to buy the S-tronic.
Right. You're doing it wrong. It's basically what they would say. So, all right. Well, moving on. I've got a nothing quite as elite as either of you. I've got a Hyundai Sonata Hybrid.
Ooh.
And,
pretty car.
It's pretty. But
that car is so, that styling, for as much as I love the Sonata styling, the Hybrid is just like, it's just so overwrought with like the clear taillights and all the other extra little things that it's doing. I actually don't like the way the Hybrid looks.
Have you noticed that it actually has different fascias on the like the lower fascia and the rear, the edges of the bumpers, they're more squared off.
Mm-hmm.
They come out further for aero. Sonata, great hybrid, that's for sure. Ha!
That's the truth.
It thumps and bumps and clunks, and like you are always aware of what the hell it's doing, and you're always asking yourself, what the hell is it doing? It is the most unresponsive car I have driven this year.
Wow.
Like you press on the pedal, and it's like, when are you going to go? Because I'm in the middle of an intersection.
Alan, you had a Patriot recently, so that says a lot.
Yes. Yes. The Patriot's not unresponsive. It's just weak. It tries. The Sonata's just kind of like, no. Not going to happen.
But it's all for the sake of fuel economy, Dan.
I guess. And it has this, it has Blue Drive, too, which is like the default position for everything. Singularly annoying. Oh my goodness, is Blue Drive annoying, because it is so unresponsive. Like, I'll put it in reverse to back out of my driveway, and I'll press the pedal, and like, it won't do anything. It's like driving bumper cars. It's like that sort of response or lack of response. Oh my goodness, is it annoying.
And correct me if I'm wrong, too. The fuel economy isn't actually that great.
Okay, so I'm driving it mostly highway.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm getting 33.5 or so. So not great, you know? But not worth the penalty in drivability either, because you can get 33.5, 34 out of a lot of different stuff that you don't need to to have a thumpy, clunky hybrid implementation going on.
Yeah, it's not, but it's their first hybrid. I give them a little credit in that it's the first one. It has to get better. It just has to.
Yeah, I mean, okay. There are some good things about this. Now, the Hyundai Kia hybrid system is designed to scale really well. So they can use it on a small car, they can use it on a larger car. The system is more flexible than some other hybrid systems. The trade-off is that they haven't invested in a CVT, you know, torque split device like Ford and Toyota have. Mm-hmm. What that means is there's a conventional transmission with an electric motor stuck in the side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it works, but it's not nearly as smooth. And this is one area where, as much as we hate CVTs, they actually smooth out the transition, the power handoff between electric motor and gas engine it doesn't happen as smoothly in this car. There are places where it's fine, it's smooth, it's unobtrusive, but there are others where it's just like kabang, and you're sort of like taken aback by how rough and unrefined and sort of decalibrated.
Well, I imagine when you create a hybrid drivetrain that's meant for various vehicle classes, large and small, you're not going to have a drivetrain that is perfectly tailored to just one.
No,
you know, it's going to be a case of like anti-middle bowl of porridge, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is it's perfectly suited to none. And that's... You also have the battery tech in the Hyundai Sonata hybrid is actually quite good. It's like a foam... It's molded actually into the trunk floor versus like a big square box because of the way the battery is built. It's actually got some sort of foam technology inside it that makes it that much more flexible. So they did a lot of engineering on it, but it just sort of it's almost like they maybe didn't have the budget or didn't have the appetite to go completely full bore into developing all kinds of specialized pieces, and they wanted to get quite far down the road without going into new transmissions and stuff that maybe won't be as good if this hybrid thing doesn't take off. We're gonna be sitting on a bunch of money that we can't use. So
sure,
I don't know. In general though, like, it's interesting this week because my Volvos are broken. Both of them.
What else is new?
Surprise.
Well, I did the brakes on the T5. And then I took it for a drive, and it's not running right. It won't rev over 4,000 RPM, and it's throwing a code for the mass airflow sensor. So.
Oh.
Fine. The other one, the 2.4T, that needs a transmission. So that's going to be fun. Merry Christmas. So I finally got the T5 all fixed tonight. But the in my driveway right now is my mother-in-law's 06 Sonata. I think it's an 06. Mm-hmm. 06 or an 07. Last-gen Sonata. And then there's this brand-new Sonata. The old one, I like it in a lot of ways. But the new one is much more stylish, much more comfortable, much more competitive in terms
of the rest of the market. Totally better car.
It's a much better car. Like, and that's the thing, like looking at the sort of general feel of the Sonata and where they've taken it, it's a really good car and it's really competitive. The hybrid aside, the hybrid doesn't count.
I was going to say, when you judge Sonata, you can't take hybrid into account for it because, I mean, the hybrid has generally been sort of poorly received, but the Sonata itself is very, very good.
Yeah, and like, at first I thought the styling was kind of overwrought, and now it's grown on me to the point where I look at it and I see sort of touches of Jaguar in it, and it's a little more restrained than I initially thought it was, and maybe that's just, again, because I've gotten used to it. Whereas yeah. I preferred the Optima, and the Optima is still a beautiful car.
The Optima is pretty. It's the Sonata hybrid. I can't do that design.
It's those aquatic and styled LEDs.
Yeah, for being such a pretty car in its non-hybrid forms, you know, the hybrid just, it's the little extra add-ons that make it look like it's like, okay, put that down. No, we don't need to put that on there. It was good looking already. It's fine, you know.
Well, I am glad.
I wonder why they did that, though. I mean, was that we know we have to make some aero. Okay.
Well, there's that, but it's like, it's got to look different. It's the hybrid. We need to put the clear lenses on.
A look at me factor, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to look like a hybrid, but a lot of that stuff is actually for aero still, but...
But like the Camry hybrid looks identical to the standard Camry.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you look, you can see some differences. The wheels are clearly different because of the aero.
Yeah. Okay, in the context of the Sonata hybrid, they
look... Well, or look at, for example, the new Accord, which I think is a relatively handsome car, and then the plug-in hybrid version, which is horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
Just really, really, really
you
ugly.
Know, it's sort of like, okay, you'd get the GT version of something. Right? The worst example I can think of is like a Grand Prix or something from the late 90s or the mid 90s. Uh-huh. Right. So you'd get like the base model. It wouldn't have that much. Oh, no. Bonneville. That's okay. So you get the Bonneville SE, right? It was ugly,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't that ugly. And then you'd get like the SSEI.
Yeah.
And it had like giant hunks of plastic on it. And yeah, it had a supercharged 3800, and that was fun, but it had those weird like 1959 cat eye headlights and taillights. It was just disgusting looking car. And it was just loaded with cladding. And that's sort of like where hybrids are now. The green version of the car is going to be like all dolled up like the performance version was back in the day. So it's going to be, they're going to take it like the one that they think you're going to want more and make it uglier. That's, I think that's where we're going with this now.
Yeah, I can see that.
Hybrid and green stuff is the new sort of high performance thing, I guess.
The new SSEI.
Yeah, hooray.
The new GXP.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a ring endorsement. Yeah, it's the next Bonneville SSEI.
Yeah, without the torquey 3.8. I mean, you know, overall, the Sonata Hybrid, again, like the car part, the just general carness of it is good. Although the way it integrates with your phone is kind of clunky. It would sometimes connect, sometimes not, with Bluetooth. And phone systems that lock out your contacts from the screen but still allow you to dial a phone number seem rather dumb.
Yeah, that's a little backwards.
Like, if I can't get at my contacts and point at a name with the touchscreen, that's two button presses, right? But if I can press the button seven times and dial a phone number, how is that safer?
Wait, I'm sorry. Do you live in a world without area codes? Just asking, because it's 10 numbers for me.
It is Dan, so it's like
it is Dan.
Gonna get off my lawn to
it's three.
Dial KL5.
Yeah.
Pets, I can just imagine you in the car, like hitting the operator.
You gotta
need to reach New York City.
Yeah. All right. Well, so all right. So we'll move on. We'll talk about fuel economy, and we'll go to Audi's new bumper crop of diesels. This seems like they're putting in a diesel in like everything they make, and I'm super psyched that they're actually putting a diesel in the Q5, because that's like a tiny little Porsche Cayenne that's going to have a diesel in it. And never mind that they're going to use it to make a tiny little Porsche CUV, and that'll probably have a diesel as well. That's the one that has me the most excited. But, you know, do you think that this is a bright future for diesel?
I think so. And I think what's really promising is that they're actually putting the 3-liter inside of the Q5, because I thought for the longest time that would just get the 2.0, you know, 4-cylinder diesel that Volkswagen and Audi have shared across a number of things. It's what's currently in the A3 TDI. So the fact that it's going to have this, you know, 406 pound-feet engine in the Q5, which isn't that big, that car is going to be really sweet.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of serious. And so in light of that, I'm just waiting for like a correction to come out and say, no, it's getting, you know, the smaller, the 4-banger TDI.
Right. Well, yeah, I can see it with the 3-liter, though, because in Europe it's sold with both. So it doesn't really shock me. If they were going to certify the 3-liter, why not just do the 3-liter in it?
Yeah, I think the most impressive one is that it, you know, it's going into the A8. And
I don't know. I thought that was sort of expected, only because Mercedes has the S-Class diesel currently out. BMW has long said they're going to do a diesel version of the 7 Series. I think the A8 diesel was sort of expected.
Yeah, and so it's just more part of just like an overall, like, you know, cafe push.
Yeah, but I mean, a vehicle the size of the A8 that gets 36 miles to the gallon.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. That's really good, especially since the S-Class, if I remember correctly, only does like 31 or 32. And even that, I mean, an S-Class with like 31 miles per gallon, that's cool.
Yeah, you would have been tarred and feathered had you said that like 15 years ago. So it's
right.
Pretty impressive.
The one I'm most impressed by, though, is that they're doing it in the A7, because the A7 to me is still sort of that like niche, not quite volume car. You know, it'd be like if Mercedes did one in the CLS, or if BMW did it in the 6 Series Grand Coupe. Like, the A7 to me never seemed like the type of car that would get a diesel here, but I'm really excited that it's happening.
And I think it makes sense in the A7, because in the grand scheme of things, diesel still is a niche, you know, choice for powertrain. So that's going to be like a very much an enthusiast car right there. I mean, I don't know if you'll see a manual in it, but you know, that will be an enthusiast special car there.
Yeah, cool. It's good that I feel as a diesel enthusiast versus like a hybrid enthusiast. I just like diesels because A, they're torquey. B, there's not a ton of special gee whiz equipment that needs to go in it. And while hybrids work and everything, I like the way diesels feel, and I know that sort of makes me a Luddite throwback, whatever. tinfoil hat guy. We're not going to get rid of electrified vehicles, and that's fine because I drove a Leaf not too long ago and I loved it. I can't wait to get my hands on the Tesla Model S. Like, I think that when it's done right, it's great. A lot of what we've seen has been sort of half-assed implementation and half-assed in terms of just the technology not being there, and the only way it gets there is by being pushed, by being out there. But, you know, maybe Audi can open the door for more diesels to come into this market from other manufacturers. You know, we've heard
talk of
Mazda and others bringing their diesels over. Please.
Well, Mazda's going to. Mazda hasn't officially told us what car is getting the diesel, but they've said that they're going to get it, and it's more than likely the Mazda 6. You know, Chevy's doing a cruise diesel pretty soon. Honda's actually been talking about bringing a diesel over for a long time. So there's a possibility there. Volkswagen's big on the initiative, so I think it's going to get better.
Well, Honda actually just introduced a brand new diesel.
And the rest
of the world.
Exactly. But there's, I mean, who knows? It could happen. And it's more likely now than it ever has been. I mean, for the longest time, it was like, oh, maybe we'll get the diesel. Right. But now it's like, no, maybe we will.
Is that how you laugh at parties?
Constantly. Only when I'm holding a giant martini glass.
Yes.
And I'm leaning back in a lazy boy. Right.
Drinking with an erect pinky.
Exactly. It's like, oh, goodness, we shan't get the diesel. Yes.
That wasn't a euphemism. No. Did you stroke your goatee at the same time? Like
with my monocle.
Yeah, so the diesel pulls up in front, your monocle falls into your martini. Baga!
Oh! My A8!
I never!
Yeah, the thing that just sort of makes me a little cautious is Audi is essentially Volkswagen. So, well, it seems like they're bringing a whole bunch of cars. Really, they federalized one extra engine, the three.
Right.
So it's kind of like it fits a lot of thing we make.
Yeah, but it's
see what's interesting though.
Squeeze. Go ahead.
I have to say this. What's interesting is maybe about a year ago or year and a half ago, I wrote a story about Audi had confirmed that they were going to do the A6, the A8, the Q5, but they had also confirmed the A4 diesel for us, and. I understand there's a new version of the A4 on its way in the future, and you know they're going to be massaging that 2-liter engine, but I'm kind of shocked that they didn't just throw that 2-liter into the A4 because it's sold like that in Europe. The 2-liter is already approved in America because it's in all the other Volkswagen Audi products. Like, why is there not an A4 TDI right now?
It does seem like a no-brainer given, like, you know, the 335D.
Right, exactly, which BMW has said there will be a new version of in the States.
I would be very much happy if they kept the four-cylinder out of the A4 diesel and gave it the 3.0T. Diesel.
The 3.0 diesel. I've driven that car. The last-gen A4, the Bosch company, had a 3-liter TDI A4 hanging around Detroit for a while. And I'll tell you, it's purely awesome. Like, it is the... It was the coolest A4 I've ever driven, aside from, like, the RS4. But, I mean, doing it with the 3-liter would be great, and it would be a total, like, 335D.
It would also be expensive.
It would be very expensive. But I thought for sure by now we would have a 2-liter TDI A4.
Well, we'll do the sort of the classic pulled punch. Time will tell.
Mm-hmm. And, hey, I'll say this. If not having a 2-liter... TDI A4 means having a Q5, an A6, an A7, and an A8. Fine. I'll take it.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
I mean, the Q5 just sort of, what's it going to compete with? There's nothing else that size that has a diesel.
No.
And that vehicle in that class drives really well. I mean, the X3 is a little bigger and is also very much improved over the original X3, but again,
well, there's also, let me double check this, but I know that BMW, some of their North American product plans had leaked not too long ago. And if I remember correctly, one of them was that the X3 would be getting, the X3 is going to be getting a diesel.
Ooh.
So this is going to be a competitive segment very soon. Mm-hmm. What do you think the GLK is going to get? Nothing?
The GLK is getting a diesel. It's that new 2.1 liter.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And that's gonna have something like 400 foot-pounds of torque or something crazy
right.
like
I
that.
I mean, the according to this report that I had found anyway about the BMW, it's supposed to be getting a 2-liter diesel four-cylinder, but I mean, still, X3 is going to have a diesel, Q5 is going to have a diesel, GLK is going to have a diesel. It's fine.
Kabang. There we go.
There it is.
Yeah, and speaking of fuel economy, the Ford is taking a different tack, and they're bringing the EcoBoost 1-liter over to America. We saw it going through the airport scanner in somebody's suitcase.
We did.
3-cylinder, 1-liter EcoBoost. Do you think America is ready for another 3-cylinder engine? I mean, George, do you remember? You may be too young.
I don't know if I was alive when there was the last 3-cylinder.
Geo Metro. You were alive.
Okay, I wasn't paying attention to Geos at the time, I suppose, then.
Right.
We have a 3-cylinder engine right now, Dan.
Smart?
The Smart for 2.
That's not a car.
Okay, so this file's right
there.
I'm saying. Cars that I haven't driven or don't know anything about. So I guess with the three cylinders, the main concern is, you know, smoothness. I know that's why, you know, 4-cylinders, one of the reasons why they're so popular is that they're, you know, comparative to, you know, a 3-cylinder is they're far more smooth.
Because what you do is you take 720, right, and divide it by 4. That's the sort of, that's how many power pulses, you know, how many degrees of crank rotation you have to go through before you get a pulse.
Well, I will say to that point, over the summer, Ford let us drive a 1-liter 3-cylinder in the Focus, the Eurospec Focus, and Jeff Sabatini drove it, and he said it was actually really smooth, and it's not what you expect out of a 3-cylinder. He said it's very good.
No, go ahead.
I would say, like, as I think they're trying a bunch of new things, like I've never heard of this before, like, you know, an offset crankshaft and variable oil pump and split cooling system, and so they're doing a bunch of little things to try and, I think, make it a more palatable and everyday usable engine instead of, you know, something that you use to mow the lawn.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot you can do with counter-rotating balance shafts and things like that. You can smooth it out and quell the vibrations to a large degree. That's not really – and you can put in nice isolating engine mounts so that while the thing's like rocking around under there, it's totally isolated from the rest of the car. So you
just like suspended like a big rubber hammock.
Yeah,
in the
yeah exactly. So, I mean, that's fine. I think – there's going to be a little bit of hesitation because it is a 3-cylinder. I'd be surprised if they sell it as a 3-cylinder so much as like the EcoBoost 1.0.
Oh, yeah. I don't think they're going to talk about the fact that it's a 3-cylinder. It's just the 1-liter EcoBoost.
Yeah.
That's all you'll hear, 1-liter EcoBoost.
And I think people are going to drive it, and they are going to be surprised because it's not a gutless engine. I mean,
Ford's estimating it's going to produce 103 horsepower and 148 pound-feet of torque, which, compared to the current Fiesta, that's 3 more horsepower, but that's 36 more pound-feet of torque.
Right.
That's huge.
Okay, not too long ago, I had a 3,300-pound car with a 2.3-liter engine that had that kind of power rating. Not too far off.
Hmm.
So, and it was a 4. It wasn't a 3, and it was iron engine, so it weighed a lot more. There's no way I could have put the block in my suitcase.
Right.
So I think that's going to be – maybe this is, again, the tip of the spear of another just sort of fuel economy technology that keeps moving forward. Is, you know, we're going to have diesel on the one hand. We're going to have lots of electrified vehicles on the other hand, and then we're going to have teeny tiny little engines boosted – to the moon, and they're all going to perform in some way to save us fuel and please us. How they're going to do both of those things at the same time, I'm still a little fuzzy on. Like, okay, so Sabatini drove the Focus with the 1-liter, and it was maybe more than you'd expect from a 3-cylinder. Was it actually a decent car to drive?
He said that in the Focus, it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't a great fit, and you know, it was a Eurospec Focus, so that, you know, the suspension, the tuning of all that, like the chassis dynamics and all that, were a little bit different. But in the Fiesta, which is smaller, lighter, I think it's going to be fine, really.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it'll be fine. And, you know, to go back to fuel economy, too, Ford is saying this will be the most fuel-efficient non-hybrid car in the United States. Well, meaning it'll have to be...
We've heard big claims before, you know.
We have heard big claims before, but that means, I mean, if they're talking highway fuel economy, presumably, it's going to have to get, like, 45 miles per gallon.
I don't think that's difficult with a turbocharged...
I don't think that's difficult either, but think about it. I mean, 45 miles per gallon out of a car with 148 pound-feet of torque.
Right.
That's kind of nuts.
Like, that's a good, really good package.
Right. And the thing is, too, for, you know, for these, for where it's going to end up, like the Fiesta and potentially the Focus, it, you know, you're not dealing in a realm where people are totally, you know, it's not like you're shopping for an M3 where you're worrying about, like, you know, power delivery and whatnot, or even, you know, a base model 1 series. It's just one of those things where if you equate it to, like, the Ford Escape that I'm driving this week, where your high feature engine is no longer the V6, it's a turbo 2 or the turbo 2 liter, where it's just, that's just the natural progression of things. And, you know, most people aren't going to notice it as long as, you know, they don't have to put their feet out and push when they have to get up to speed on a highway.
Okay. So, but that's fine. My biggest question about this is, okay, this is an engine it's rendered in aluminum. It's got direct injection and it's turbocharged. What's it going to cost in the Fiesta? I mean, are you going to be spending right. Focus money on a Fiesta just so you can have electric power?
That's the thing. And, you know, Ford doesn't say anything about pricing, of course. But there's a line in the press release. Let me find it. It's pretty good. It's pretty Ford, actually, where it says... they were talking about... Oh, yeah, it says, adding an EcoBoost engine costs about $995 in most Ford vehicles. Earlier they said pricing is not set... But as with other EcoBoost engines available across Ford's car, truck, SUV, and crossover lineup, the 1 liter will be a very affordable option. So think about Fiesta pricing currently. You can get one up to, what, like 18?
Yeah, very affordable for who?
Right.
It's very affordable if you find it through Ford credit.
If you can get one at 18 right now, and you figure this will be about, we'll say, a $1,000 upgrade... That's a $19,000 Fiesta.
Yeah, but you know at that point it's like totally loaded where you're going to drop back to a mid-grade Focus. So, it's sort of like we have to get past this price always equals size. Bigger is better, that kind of thing.
Right.
Like, if
exactly.
you get exactly what you want, like, and Ford has even said, they came out and said, you know, yeah, all this attention on smaller cars is going to put pressure on our profits. You know, like, there's just no way to make them more profitable. You get them to a smaller size, and then they still cost just as much. Like, there's no more you can get out of it, and
right.
that's what's gonna happen. And so it's not just. The smaller car is more affordable and more efficient. It's got to be what people want. And do you really think that people are going to want a Fiesta when they get a Focus for the same money?
I mean, if they can get there are people I know that would rather have a loaded Fiesta than a mid-grade Focus because they're the people that the size isn't necessarily what matters. It's the features and the content.
They're called Europeans.
Right.
Steve doesn't live in Europe. He lives in Detroit.
Right.
That's true. Okay, so then that does make a little
sense. Oh, but that's kind of close to Canada. Maybe they're called, what are they, Québécois?
Québécois,
They're kind of like Europeans. They speak a different language, and they're arrogant. Right?
No, I'm just saying, I'm starting to, I mean, maybe it's the, I'm not. I hate this term so much, but I'm going to say it. The millennials who want content, like, I'm one of those people. When I look for a car, it's not necessarily about space. It's about content.
Right.
You know, my content...
You're a millennial, so you're hip, and you live an urban lifestyle, and you're active.
Right.
And you listen to M83.
Right? So you're like, okay, so you're my generation, just like 10, 15 years younger.
Mm-hmm.
See, because we were buying the Jetta K2. Would you buy a Jetta K2?
I did not buy a Jetta K2.
But would you?
Yeah,
because we were the millennials before there were millennials, and they tried to market the hell out of us too.
Oh, I know,
all kinds of cynical crap.
But we're the millennials now, Dan.
Yeah, so
go back to your porch. Get out of my ergonomically planned green living apartment.
A self-sustaining lawn.
Thank you very much for footing the bill for my parents.
No problem.
No, what Steve is right, though, in that, you know, you're getting a crop of people now that care less about horsepower and they care more about being able to, you know, sync their phone to their car seamlessly. And that's where the content is going to pay dividends through stuff like, you know, for Chevy with like MyLink and stuff like that. That's going to be a buying feature for us, quote unquote, millennials. I'm right. Steve's right. I hate using that term.
It's because it's a bogus term. It's not just millennials that care about technology. I actually like the technology in cars. I like the improvements that they've made. The problem is that it's not quite there in a lot of places. I love using technology if it's easy to use. I hate using it if it sucks, and a lot of it sucks.
And the quote-unquote millennials are like that too. But, I mean, like I said, my biggest point here is that it's not so much about size. It's not that a Focus is bigger than a Fiesta, because honestly, a Focus isn't even really that much bigger than a Fiesta. It's the fact that you could get a loaded Fiesta for the price of a mid-grade Focus.
Right.
And for my eyes anyway, I would rather have a loaded Fiesta.
Except for the Fiesta's ugly.
Well, okay, but
what I'm asking, though, is
aside from slightly more space inside, what about the mid-grade Focus versus the loaded Fiesta is attractive to me? Like, what makes me say, oh, I should get this?
Well, the Focus drives better.
But,
again,
I mean, we haven't driven the new Fiesta yet. We don't, you know, let's say that. But for the people that don't really care about driving dynamics.
For the people
either.
That don't care about. No, I mean, it's a good place to be, and it's a good package, because by going with an engine that is smaller and more fuel efficient, you're going to get the people that care about that, you know, and you're going to also be able to put it in the car that's more premium. So you're going to get the people that care about the smaller, more efficient engine, but they don't have to penalize themselves to get it.
Right.
All of a sudden, they're buying the smallest, most efficient engine in the highest trim car because you want the stuff and you want the efficiency. And that's a pretty smart thing, because in the past, you'd have to get the, you know, Geo Metro with the paint mixer option, where the steering wheel just shakes in, like, you know, around three axes as you grab it, and it makes your elbows knock together. Like, it's just, you know, instead of punishing yourself, you do get what you want. So, you know, I guess the again, it remains to be seen how well that's going to work out, but at least they're working on something. Although I still think a Fiesta with a V8 in the middle of it would be plenty entertaining.
But only if it stays front wheel drive.
Okay, deal. I'll take it.
All right, you can have a mid-engine V8 Fiesta as long as it stays front wheel drive.
I'll take
it. That's all I want, and I want it to still be on. Like, what is that car on? 15s or 16s?
Yeah. Is it on 15s?
I want. Well, okay. Well,
okay.
I want
listen,
on,
you can put on 13s.
I want it on 13s with like Bridgestone Ecopia tires.
How awesome! That would be so evil to drive.
Well, Dan has
it. Would
project.
Just it would flip over itself.
I think. You know, because I think stuff should be more dangerous to let you appreciate every single breath you take. That would be,
you know what?
Awesome.
That's a very good point. I was talking, not to get off topic completely here, but I was talking to a friend of mine a couple weeks ago. We had the Mazda Miata Super 20.
Yes.
And which is a very raw, pure, like, I mean, they took a Miata with 27,000 miles on it, threw a supercharger on it, did all this crazy stuff to it. It was a concept car that was only made to, like, go to and from shows, and they gave it to us. So everything rattled. Everything felt like it was going to break. Like, it was just such an experience from getting out of – I had been in a Lexus GS right before
I
that.
I love that car, the GS.
I do, too. But the GS, let's be honest, sort of just drives itself. And then you get into the Miata with this supercharger on it and, you know, like really, really wide Toyo tires. And every little thing that you do is just immediate reaction. And everything you do causes a reaction. It's refreshing to be in a car like that because it reminds you how much, like, it reminded me how much I enjoy driving
it
and
makes
actually
you drive.
Driving a car.
That's,
it's such, it was so rewarding and it was nice to be in.
That, I mean, felt like that when I drove the Factory 5, Cobra replica, where you just have to like bear hug the car to drive it anywhere.
Mm-hmm. It's great. I love cars like that.
Makes you feel alive, man.
Yeah, more cars should be like that. Well, the Autoblog podcast is brought to you by the Tire Rack, the leading online source for tires and much more, such as wheels, wheel covers, windshield wipers, engine and brake fluids, lighting, and more. You can shop Tire Rack at TireRack.com. So speaking of more fuel-saving tech, GM says that they're going to sell 500,000 electric cars by 2012. Kinda. And by kinda, yeah. Explain what they mean by kinda.
Oh, this drives me nuts. This is all. It's almost like the 230 MPG banner all over again. Like, right. not as, in such a bad way, but like they make this bold statement and they go, you know, by the way, we don't mean all electric vehicles. We mean, you know, e-assist and whatnot, which is fine. I think e-assist is
awful.
It will get better, and it's the key to e-assist. What I think makes
e-assist the key to e-assist is not buying it. That's the key to e-assist.
No, what makes e-assist important, not in its current practice, but the notion of being able to take something unintrusive, like swapping out an alternator for a generator, adding a battery pack, and having that work. That one,
right? It's the fact that the e-assist system is so plug and play with so many different cars in the entire GM portfolio. That's what's good about it.
Once again, GM has developed a technology that makes every single car in their range potentially suck.
But you could take that. You could take that technology and you could retrofit that to your Bonneville SSEI.
But why would you do that?
For more fuel economy, once they get it right.
Fuel economy be damned. Supercharged 3800. You set the e-brake, that sucker will drag the back wheels.
Listen, in like 10 years, every single car on the market is going to be hybrid. It have some form of hybrid tech in one way or another.
Yeah.
Like with anti-lock brakes, it was, you don't have a label on the car anymore that says ABS.
Right, that's true.
Part of the package.
Right.
So,
no, I don't disagree. I mean, look at what BMW is doing with their Active-E, and not Active-E, but all of their efficient dynamic stuff.
Right, like the brake regen and all that. It's just there now. But no, this GM thing of saying there's going to be 500,000 electric vehicles, what they really mean is 500,000 vehicles that have some sort of electrification in them somewhere, somehow, kind of.
I don't know how they can find a tool in their workshop, because everything this must be labeled wrong. You know, 3/8 is like 1/2 inch and stuff like that. Like that would be like saying, I have nothing to go off on that. It's just such a misrepresentation of what the reality is of what they're really trying to say.
It's right. Well, but
if you tell people we're going to sell 500,000 electric cars by 2017, they're like, wow, because they just think of a pure EV. They think of an electric car. So yeah, it's just...
But also, just, like, okay, so even if they're selling that many sort of electric and electrified, like light electric vehicles, which is what they call the e-assist stuff, they call it light electrification.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're adding that much volume to it, that's going to push the technology. It's going to get, like, you know, like installed user base to a software company like Microsoft. It's going to get it out there, and it's going to further the development of that technology.
Sure. Which, and I think, you know, in theory, systems like e-assist are very good. What they can do and provide for a car it's a very good thing. It might not be done well right now, but 5 years from now, it might be the greatest system.
Yeah, once they figure out how to put it in the car and make it not suck all the life out of it,
right,
that'll be fine.
Until right. Well, also, it's, you know, it's in Buicks right now and a Malibu.
Right.
You perfect the technology in places where people don't notice, and then you shove
exactly.
it
in the car. You put it in the car is that, like, if I'm going to judge a system for its dynamic capability, I'm not going to test it in a LaCrosse.
But no, my problem with it isn't even the dynamic capability. My problem with the e-assist system is that it's obtrusive.
I don't think it's obtrusive at all.
It's obtrusive. It's obtrusive dynamically for sure, but it's also like it's not bad from the driver's seat. But damn, that thing is loud when you got people in the back seat, and
it is loud and takes up your trunk space. But from a behind the wheel perspective, I think it's fine to drive. It's not like Sonata Hybrid.
No, that's true. And again, like that's the thing. Like if you're gonna do it, you got to have some of the pain before you have some of the
right
the sort of smoothness out of it. I guess.
Right, and I mean the e-assist system that GM has right now is sort of the next evolution of what was the old mild hybrid system that was in the like the Aura and the last Malibu. And
so that's, I mean, yes, they've refined the belt alternator system.
Right. Exactly. Because that system in those cars, that was terrible. That was really, really bad. So to see it move up to where it is now at ESS, it's like, okay, it's better. It's getting there. But, I mean, it can only improve.
And that's important that they get that right, because that hypothetically, once they get that right, is such a low-cost way to,
right,
quote-unquote, electrify a car.
Right, and I mean, think about it. If you, you know, you match it with, it's currently paired with, you know, the 2.4 liter direct injection four cylinder. In its next generation, it'll likely move to that 2.5 liter four cylinder that they have now. And if you think about it, you know, I remember talking to the GM people when the LaCrosse ESS had come out, and I said, so would this theoretically work with any 2.4 liter equipped car? And they said, yeah, we could put it in anything. So if they have that same thing with the 2.5, and the 2.5 is going to go into all these different cars, every single one of them, in theory, could be E-Assist.
I think it's more than just the sort of 2.5, 2.4 thing. Any car could get that system, because it is just a series of components. It's really like three modules, right? It's the heavy-duty alternator, the battery, the
generator.
It's an alternator generator kind of thing. Like, you know, it's not a generator in the sense that it makes DC. It's an alternator. It makes alternating current. It's just, it's more hefty, where it can provide some more oomph to the whole. It's an electric supercharger, if you will.
Okay.
In some way. So there's that unit, there's the sort of control module, and then there's the battery, in very simple terms. You know, so there's really only three components. It scales really well. You know, you could put this on a truck.
They'll put that in everything. It will be in everything in, like, you know, 7 years.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I don't necessarily want it.
Well,
you don't know that you want it.
I don't want it.
If it was in a car and you didn't notice it, would you even care?
Yes, because eventually it'll break. But also, like, again, it gets back to the sort of like elemental thing, like, and maybe that's why I'm going to be driving the cars that I have for like the next three decades, because you know, as technology marches on, I feel like some of this is you know, getting to the point where we're making vehicles full of technology and full of all this equipment, while on the other hand, we're completely ignoring the idea that we could put development dollars into other stuff, like maybe not driving as much, which I realize is completely opposite to what car guys should be talking about. But then again, if the roads were clear and free for us enthusiasts to not sit in traffic jams, I think that's pretty good. So I don't know. I'm not as excited about the E-Assist setup as GM is, apparently. I just don't think it's pleasing to drive at this point. And yeah, it'll get better. The Volt is certainly an impressive piece of technology. Again, you know, not enthusiast pleasing unless you're an enthusiast of that kind of vehicle. And at that point, it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And that's going to get better. And
that's another car that in two different occasions they sort of misrepresented what it was. First with the 230 MPGs, and then, you know, you can call it, yeah, I guess, extended range. MPG, excuse
me. Is that like RPMs?
Yeah. Thanks.
Miles so like, per gallons.
But, like, you look at the whole, you know, extended range EV, and they called it, you know, at the very beginning of this, they were calling it, you know, full electric, and, you know, putting the asterisks on the fact that it had a you know, an ICE in it. And I'm wondering, you know, when the Corvette comes out in January, they're going to say that, like, it can fly. You know, based on the way that they just misrepresent.
Well, if you put wings, like, from a U2 on it, you can certainly get it off the ground.
I mean, let's be honest. We could make a Corvette fly.
A Corvette doesn't really need much help flying.
Exactly. Yeah, the Corvette will just sort of, it will naturally just kind of take off.
Yeah.
Vin Diesel made one fly in XXX.
Vin Diesel is an idiot.
But he can make a Corvette fly. So what does that say?
He was pretty funny on Kimmel.
Well, because that's in comparison to Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel.
Disagree.
Oh, and what do you like?
I don't want. I don't.
You
don't.
Stay up late so you can catch Carson Daly, right?
No, God, no. I'm actually, my, like, you know, my 1 a.m. hours, I'm too busy watching, like, Roseanne reruns.
Oh,
so.
My God.
Wow.
Stop, Steve.
I should just, okay, I'm done.
Dan, can you edit that out at the end?
I'm going to leave that in. I'm going to make it louder. That's going to be the loudest part of the podcast. I watch Roseanne reruns at 1 a.m.
I'm proud of it.
Like a cup of warm milk and some saltines while you're at it?
No, usually some tea.
Decaf or regular?
Oh, regular. I go full strength.
God, wait. If you were watching Roseanne, I thought you might have like a 40 of Old English.
No.
It's not like if you're watching like Dan Connor's Greatest Hits. Yeah,
I'm not watching the Golden Girls. Jeez.
Well, speaking of high technology and cars, another thing that sort of, I'll use Zach's analogy. It's like you take the cat and you rub its fur the completely wrong way. The right. NTSB thinks that we should all benefit from intrusive safety technology that we don't want. Instead of all of us learning how to drive and paying attention, they want to make they want to force me to take something that I find completely abhorrent, and that is dynamic cruise control, which I hate with a passion. They want to make that standard, which is I right there stop.
I don't hate dynamic cruise control, but I don't ever use it. But the thing is, I don't use cruise control.
I do. I use cruise control every day, all the time.
I can honestly say, and this is not an exaggeration, this is not a shunk literally, I have not used cruise control in probably 2 years.
Yeah, but you drive in the city most of the time or on the highway?
I drive a lot of highway. And I mean, I do a lot of back and forth trips between Detroit and Chicago. It's 4.5 hours each way. It's just I-94 the whole way. I don't use the cruise.
Why?
I don't like it because I don't like not ever having complete control over what my car is doing.
Okay.
Yeah, I seldom use cruise control, but if it's a car that has dynamic cruise control, I use that like 100% of the time.
Oh, yeah. I only use dynamic cruise because I think it's actually really good.
Contrary to Dan, it's right. Dynamic cruise is awesome.
I don't think it's good, though, as a safety feature. I just think it's kind of cool.
Expletive hate dynamic cruise control because it's always jamming on the brake. Like cruise control, the whole point of cruise control, right, is efficiency. So at a certain point you want to coast. You don't want to ride up on the end, you know, ride up on the bumper of someone and just keep riding the brakes. And that's what dynamic cruise does. I hate it.
But it does it from like a safe distance of like 20 feet and like
right.
Like okay, the whole point of highway driving is to see, anticipate, and coast. And you can do that with regular cruise. You just hit the little button and it'll coast.
But
and
different zoom. Different brands have different versions of it. And
better than others.
Some are better than others. And the only thing that I would
good.
The only thing that I would like to see it improve upon is like you have your three distance settings in a lot of cases. You know, you have, you know, 20 feet, 40 feet, and 60 feet. I would like there to be a ride the ass of the guy in front of me setting because if you're 20 feet out and you slow down or whatever distance they seem to be safe as the closest setting and you match speed, that's too far enough away to let the guy in front of you know that he should be getting out of the way.
Yeah, but at that point, you're not using cruise.
Yeah, I just...
I absolutely disagree that there should be like a ride the ass setting. I'm not saying I get your point, but I'm also not the type of person that, like, if they're in the left lane and I want them to go faster, I don't just get up on them.
No, I pass them like, on the right when I have a chance.
Hey, I'll pass them on the right. If it's really bad, I might, like, flash my brights or something, but...
Oh, you're one of those?
No. I've probably done that once in my life, honestly.
That's a good way to have somebody jam on the brakes in front of you. You don't want to do that.
I've never had anyone do that to me. But well, I don't...
Like, if somebody brights me like that, I'll move over. The flash to pass.
The only time I flash my brights at someone is if their brights are on coming at me, and I'm like, dude, okay, they're on.
But dynamic cruise aside, there's other technology.
Right. I totally agree with you. I just had this conversation with a friend of mine about the active park assist in the Ford cars where the car will parallel park for you.
One of
my friends was saying like, yeah, you know, like that parallel parking system, that's really cool. I said, yeah, you know what else is really cool? Being able to parallel park a car yourself. because that's what you're taught to do and that's what you should. If you can't park a car, you shouldn't be on the road driving. I know there are people that have issues with it, but seriously, if you can't put a car into a parking space, you shouldn't be in a car.
Right, but I think that's what happens is we get a lot of folks that feel like driving is a right, not a privilege, and it's not something that requires a lot of concentration because vehicles just, I mean, they are very easy to drive in general. So you just get in your thing and you just point it where you want to go and it goes, and it stops when you step on that square pedal, and hooray. But there's, like, I see this because every day at the end of my street, there's student drivers trying to make a three-point turn, and it takes them hours. And I'm trying to get to work. And I'm like, would you get the Chevy Cruze out of the road, please? I need to go. But we don't teach people how to drive. We teach people...
No, we don't.
You know, how to... Again, like, you may have a parallel parking test, and you may, you know, you go for the little ride and drive that's like a mile, and they'll see if you blow through a stop sign or something.
No, we teach people how to operate a motor vehicle.
Right.
You teach someone how to make the car go. And make the car stop. That's it. No one is taught how to drive. I mean, I vividly remember my driving test. The instructor that I had was literally, it's like sitting in the front seat, turned around, flirting with my mom in the back seat, and he would only look in front to tell me where to go next.
Hey, let's go have lunch.
Like, he could have cared less about how I was driving.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Yeah,
it's really.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. It's not going back. You know, like, it's there's no way that you're gonna say, all right, everybody, that's it. You guys all gonna learn how to drive well, and you have to stop watching NASCAR and watch F1.
No, you also have to love
turbocharged engines, and you also have to like. It's almost like you can't expect the people to do that. So. What would you rather have?
I would rather have people who know how to drive because
But Dan, we have to be realistic. And George is making a very good point where this, unfortunately, as much as we would all like it to, is not going to change. So let's at least make it better in this post people don't know how to drive world.
I don't know. I think, like, if you're going to be stupid, you deserve to die, and we shouldn't be spending $1,000 on every
other people out with you. So, like, if the lady next to you is distracted and she's on her cell phone, that's your ass if she cuts over two lanes.
Right,
so,
but you're supposed to be watching every day. Don't you watch and you go, that guy's going to blow right through that stop sign? And they do.
Yeah.
You know, and you've seen it and you've anticipated because
you're... Yeah, but it's those moments where you're driving. You know, like this is an incident that happened to me where you're driving on the highway and you are about to pass another car. You're going 5 miles an hour faster than them and you're going by them and you don't know that Mercury Mariner is just going to all of a sudden swerve into the side of your Kia Forte Coupe. And you're going to get sideswiped, and the whole side of the car is going to get crashed in.
Well, it's a Mercury Mariner, so you know they're for sure going to do that.
Right, but that's the thing is, if those people that are not good drivers that are going to do that stuff that I didn't even know they were on their way over, or I had no time to avoid it or anything, if we can somehow make them a little bit better, even if it's with flashing lights and bells and whistles, fine, let's do it.
Here's the thing. All right, the stuff that's cheap and easy to implement, I don't have a problem with a system that, if it's switchable.
Right.
I don't have a problem with sort of a lane warning system if I can shut it off because I don't personally want it. I have a fear that it's going to be like airbags or some of the stability control systems where you can't fully disable it.
That's my fear as well. But I'm, like you said, I'm all for the simple things. Right. Like, I think
that's honestly expensive, and it's fine to do. Dynamic Cruise is not inexpensive. There's a bunch of sensors. There's software. There's stuff that goes along with it. I don't want that in my car. If I want it, I should be able to pay for it. If I don't want it, I shouldn't be forced to take it. You know,
but stuff like that, the Nissan Easy Fill tire system.
That's
is
awesome.
That's like no brainer. Why haven't we thought of this before? That is really cool.
Right.
It's great because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, tire pressure is a huge safety thing. Like, if you don't have your tires filled correctly, that can cause issues.
But see, I come back to, why are we putting this responsibility on the shoulders of the auto industry and the car buyers? this should be something where, because when people get in car accidents, right, they use our public responder, our first responders. Mm-hmm. They go to our hospitals. They get health care at the emergency room, whether they have insurance or not. So we're all paying for it. So why don't we come up with a better federally funded driver education program?
I agree. I still firmly believe that people should be retested every 5 years.
And you need to, oh, absolutely, need to make a breakpoint where you have to say, you know what, people aren't just going to do that, or they're not going to get any better. Well, you know what, you have to force it to get better. And you can't, mm-hmm, force, like, I don't want to have to pay because people can't drive. And I also don't want to have to be forced to accept things I don't want in my automobile because,
right,
people can't use the device that they've bought.
I agree. Okay. The stuff that is defeatable, the stuff that you can turn off in a car, if it's going to be there, fine. As long as I can press a button and it goes away, I'm okay with that. But it's the stuff that, like, the Mazda lane departure warning that you can't turn off is just, like, so obnoxious to me.
Yeah, I'd be out there with a pair of snips.
You know this technology is going to be good? Is not just for the fact that we're all, you know, everybody's like distracted drivers and, you know, looking at, you know, your tablets and smartphones. But when Dan or somebody like Dan who refuses to adopt the technology turns 93 and, you know, he has a system that locks him out from plowing through a farmer's market, everybody will be happy for it.
You know, when I'm 93, I'm either, you know, I'm hopefully.
Okay, George, here's the thing. Dan's not going to plow through the farmer's market. He's going to power slide through the farmer's market.
On purpose?
Listen, yeah, with crash standards, nobody's going to get hurt. The thing's going to be made out of foam.
Exactly. It'll just, like, I mean, we have cars these days where I just said this off the cuff to a friend of mine. I'm like, if I drove a BMW 5 Series into a boulder and then it fell into a lake, the car would float because there are so many airbags.
Yeah, it just gets back to, you know, this is the price of ignorance versus the cost of education. And I have to think that we're making heavy, expensive, inefficient cars to protect us from ourselves when really we could educate people. You could take somebody and put them in, God, you could put them in a Fox Body, you could put them in a Fairmont and teach them basic vehicle dynamics. Take them out on a big surface where you can wet it down, you can show them the way the vehicle reacts, you can get them comfortable with it to the point where they get some of that practice, the innate sense of counter steering and things like that. After a while, once you've practiced with it, you're not comfortable to the point clearly of like going out and drifting, but mm-hmm, it also doesn't freak you out and you have that practice where your hands automatically do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, but the suite of sensors, like, you know, the automated cruise control or the distance cruise control and the lane departure warning system, this suite of sensors is going to be used for, I think somebody from Cadillac called it super cruising, where it's not fully automated car, but you can basically do cruise control where you're also not using inputs to the wheel, too. It's staying within the dotted yellow lines.
Why bother driving? Take the friggin' train.
That's the point, that basically you're going to get to a point where, okay, you could try teaching, you know, every little knucklehead on the corner how to be a good handling driver. Or what's more realistic is that you're going to create a system where these oblivious drivers are going to just put it on autopilot and go.
Well, and that's the thing, though, is, you know, you get back to the whole right versus privilege. There are so many people that they just don't care about driving. They don't, and it's not that they don't care about like performance or dynamics. They would rather be doing other things.
Well, listen, I would rather not pay taxes, but at a certain point, right, like, you know, there are things that you have to drive to get where you're going. You can't always take public transport. It's not there. So when I say just take the train, I realize that's not practical in a lot of regions and in a lot of places. The car is the most efficient transport, you know, I especially like, and even in comparison to like a city bus, if the bus has like 10 people on it, guess what? Those 10 people driving a car each is more efficient than the bus.
Right. I mean, I'm going to, like, tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to my office, which is 15 miles away. There is a bus stop right outside of my apartment and that bus will take me all the way to my office, but I guarantee it will be more efficient for me to drive.
Likely. You know, I guess it's...
And it will take me a third as long.
It's more than one technology. Like, I'm not completely opposed to safety tech, but I think it goes hand in hand with some actual, like, driver education.
Well, you know, Google made a very interesting assertion. They said that it's a mode of transportation like a bus, and the only flaw in the equation is us as human individuals. Now, we like driving from the standpoint of the enthusiast pastime of driving, the act of driving. But we don't like going – we don't like commuting. We don't like the past. The commuting's not a pastime. So if you can take that factor out of the equation for every knucklehead on the road who doesn't care for driving the way that we do, then yeah, it does sort of put into question the right versus privilege thing. And if you can create a car that drives itself, then it does become a right.
Right. I think both of you have very – I mean, I agree with both of you in different facets. I completely agree with George that if it's not going to change, we should at least be protecting, unfortunately, the people that don't care, and that no matter what happens, they're not going to want to drive, and they're not going to care, and they're not going to listen, because there will always be people like that. However, I completely agree with Dan that we should have better education. We should have better testing requirements. We should have more frequent testing requirements. Like, there's a lot we could do. It just comes to a point of, you know, who's going to make what sides happen and when.
Right. And I know it's difficult to move a population to sort of say, yeah, you've been getting sort of a free ride for a while. Now, guess what? You're going to have to take these tests, and you're going to have to come back in 5 years and take them again. But, I mean, we inspect cars for safety. How is this that much different than me going every year or two for my mass state inspection on my car, where they jack it up and they check the tie rod ends and stuff like that? I mean, it's the same kind of thing. You know, you got to check the reflexes of the driver, and it does come down to, well, what do you do for the people who, you know, either their reflexes aren't what they, you know, they're not okay. What do you do for those people? How do you provide transportation for them? How do they get around? Like, I realize it opens a can of worms.
Right.
But
people that are either too old or are, you know, the whole automated car thing can potentially open up people who are disabled to be able to get to places they need to be.
Yeah, and also, but the flip side of the automated car is, like, if you make it too easy, then how do you make the car sort of alert somebody within enough time so that they put their phone down or whatever, and they look, and they can react, because they have to look, they have to analyze, and then they have to put in the appropriate inputs.
And that's the only system that is – so you have the two versions. You have the passive versus active, the alert versus the car takes action. I don't like the way that the Mercedes GLK takes action when you're drifting out of the lane and it corrects the steering. I do not like that. What I do like is on the Volvo, where if you're coming up on an object,
it flashes the light in the windshield.
It flashes the light in the windshield, but then if you're coming up on it fast enough, it will engage the brake because it knows that you do not have the time to react to that. It's the only system like that that's active that I do like.
Yeah, I've gotten it to, like, flash on the windshield, which scares the hell out of your family when they're in the car and they don't know what's going to happen.
The things like that scene from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, like, you're in between the two trailers.
They're just kind of like, what is that? Oh, don't worry about it. This is a car thinks it's going to crash.
That door's going to fall off.
Yeah, I love what they did to that K car in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's just epic.
I would love to know where that car is now.
Yeah, maybe they buried it with John Candy. So anyway, we've really killed the driver safety thing. I would like to touch, and I don't know, maybe you or Steve, did you guys pay any attention to the Austin F1 race? Do you think that that's, because Bill C in Kentucky asks if you think that that's sort of a harbinger of a return of F1 to the U.S.
I actually did not get a chance to watch any of it over the weekend. I was occupied with a bunch of other stuff, so
I did not watch it either. I was apartment hunting, so I hope that's not like a harbinger of, you know, two enthusiasts not paying attention to the race is a bad omen.
No, I didn't watch it. I read the wrap up, and while I was disappointed that our friend Baron von Klutsch didn't get picked as a NBC commentator for F1. I from what it sounds like, because of the way the race went off virtually without a hitch, and the finish was great, you know, it's much better than it could have gone. So it's kind of an auspicious start for the motorsports park down there. And I think it's probably going to – we're going to really see it come into its own or completely end in disaster next year.
Well, it'll take off like this, and if the New Jersey race ever happens, it'll take off when the sport moves to NBC. Because – if with cable companies, either you have velocity or you have speed, and for whatever reason, you very few cable providers do both.
I think I have one, both. I don't know.
Okay, well then I need to know what provider you have, because I've had
Fios.
You know, I move. Okay, so I've had what, RCN in when I was in my old apartment, and then at my parents' house it's Comcast, and you know you get one at one place and one at the other, but not both. And I was scrambling around looking for speed and I couldn't find it. They're going to run every American race, North American race, and that includes Montreal and Austin. They're going to be on the NBC network, but those races that are in America are going to be on NBC, the main network, not the sports network.
Well, I do have to say, when I take the time to pay attention to not even just F1, but like, you know, generous sports car racing and all of the other stuff that's not NASCAR, I'm enthralled, and I sit there and I just watch it, you know, even the prototype classes and stuff. So
yeah.
That's my favorite racing, yeah.
If that's more accessible, and you know the commentating goes a long way towards it too, because people are going to not understand it, so the announcers are going to need to make it really engaging, and I think that picking the right people is going to do that. So I would love to see more racing attention besides just the roundy-round NASCAR, which is not about the racing anymore because it's a spec series. It's about the personalities of the drivers, which, and don't get me wrong, the NASCAR cars
are, week.
Yeah, I mean, they're difficult to drive, but don't get me wrong. Like, it takes skill to keep one of those things going around in circles. But on the other hand, you know, the different classes of racing and the technology that's in F1, it's just that much more interesting to me. So, and there's going to be a ton of races down in Austin too. It's not just F1. It's like everything.
Australian Supercar Series.
Yeah. Don't they have that V8 Altima?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the Supercar Series or is that something else?
No, that's for the Supercar Series.
Yeah, it's for Supercar.
Yeah. See? Is that V8 in front wheel drive?
Should be. But is it mid-engine?
No, I don't think it's... Well, is it front mid or is it like mid?
Oh, no, I want like behind the seats mid.
Oh, you want a rear mid-engine?
I want a rear mid-engine.
I see.
Like my Fiesta.
Well, see, that's what makes the Australian series so interesting is that it, you know, look at the Altima. It's like the Camry is for NASCAR. It's a car that is nothing like the, you know, the dealership version in that it's, you know, rear wheel drive and has a V8.
I know. Isn't that me being a hypocrite talking about how awesome that thing is? And then
no. But the difference is, In the Australian version, they actually turn right, and the cars are set up to handle well.
It's the Coriolis effect. That's all.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No. But it's a road course, and the cars are designed for road courses. And I hate the notion of a race series where the two road courses that you have in that race series, half the drivers just chalk up as like, oh well, we're going to do crappy this week. Like it's professional wrestling on a race course. It's a joke.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind some of the money that's in it, though.
Yeah.
Car Snob asks, he's a control freak and therefore a manual transmission snob. What gets better fuel economy, slowly accelerating in the highest possible gear without lugging the engine, or reasonable acceleration until you can cruise in top gear? One may use less gas to get up to speed, but takes longer to get to maximum efficiency. The other uses more gas to get to maximum efficiency more quickly. What do you guys think? Were you taught to picture the egg under the gas pedal?
No.
I was.
You were?
No, I was not.
See, anybody who says it to me, I'm like, you're full of crap. You know what makes cars the most efficient? You put it in the highest possible gear. You open the throttle as wide as possible without inducing any extra enrichment. And your pumping losses go kabang down. And that's the most efficient. And you can cite the BMW 528e of the early 80s that had a crazy tall rear end and a rather torqueless engine. And the more you open that throttle, the better your fuel economy is once you learn how to drive it. And to, like, you don't want to go like wide open, you just want to, you know, have the thing the throttle mostly open, because then it's not, you know, your vacuum is reduced. And I think that's the engineering answer. I don't know.
Probably. I mean, it's not the fun answer.
It's kind of fun to, like, you know, accelerate briskly instead of putt away.
Yeah, putt away is, you know, if you notice how, you know, a 6 or 7 speed automatic does when it's in eco mode, is sort of how you want to be doing it. I know that's sad to hear, but that's sort of
it is. But no, it's the truth. I hear you.
Was that a yawn, Steve?
I think
that was a yawn.
have we made you tired?
No, I'm not. I don't feel good today, so I'm extra tired.
Maybe you should have some tea now. I can act like Blanche.
I was drinking tea throughout the entire podcast, and you'll even be happy to know that I was out of my mug that has different silhouettes of cats on it.
Oh my science.
Because I'm apparently older than Dan.
Yeah. You wearing an Argyle sweater?
You took that away from me. I was about to say that.
No, but I own several.
Are they like cardigans? Do they button, or is it like
cardigans?
Okay.
Well, I'm drinking iced tea.
I won't judge. I won't judge.
Hot tea.
You know, it's fine.
I make hot tea and then I ice it.
I just make hot tea.
Something about hot tea. I don't know. I think I just get too much of the green tea, ice green tea at Starbucks that I just started making it myself.
Okay.
Oh, I love hot tea.
This has nothing to do with the podcast, so let's get back.
It has everything to do with the podcast.
So Joe in Michigan asks, we've said a lot about how much we don't believe in the Germans for reliability. Now picture you're spending your own money, right? Would you go for a 3 or 4 year old CPO BMW or Audi or Mercedes, or are you wasting your money?
It depends. I don't know. I might go on the BMW.
Really?
I might do it. Only because I sort of hate myself.
Well, clearly. You watch Roseanne, you drink tea, Mark Alsmans.
I mean, I would do it. It's not my first choice, but I wouldn't call it wasted money.
Wasted money is that $5,000 you lose off the hood the moment the car drives off the lot.
Right.
Well, I mean, but that's with...
Yeah, but that's anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's with anything. I mean, it's CPO. CPO means they've detailed it very well, and they say they go through a checklist. I'm sure they do. I'm sure some dealers are sort of better than others in terms of CPO. They make a lot more profit on these cars, so... I don't know, and the reason why I'm sort of skeptical of it is that most of these cars are lease cars,
right?
And most of them now, over the last few years, they've had the services included, which means that all it's ever gotten is oil changes and filters.
Yeah.
When you go back and you look at the old BMW service intervals for that first 50,000 miles. There were a lot of things that were like check and replace and, you know, keep up on that are just like, yeah, they've engineered it to last 100,000 miles without needing any of that now. And so that's what they do. So I feel like, and I'm kind of paying the price for this by buying 2 European cars with 50,000 miles on them. Well, one of them had 85.
And you bought Volvos too. Yeah.
Well, because they're worth nothing.
Yeah. Who's the masochist here?
Hey, yeah. I they're decently safe cars. I still get in them, okay? And see, this is the thing. You'll get in that BMW, you'll get in that Mercedes or whatever, and you'll drive and you go, it's a pretty nice car to drive. It's luxurious. I still like it. Because that's what I do with my Volvos. They're 10 years old. I still like them. Mm-hmm. You know, that side of it is great. But it's okay, it's expensive luxury car stuff. You know, some of the things are going to stop working. Some of the electronic modules are going to lose their minds completely, so your mirrors will point at the sky. Whatever, you'll have to either sort it out or they'll tell you, like, hey, we can't fix that without the $4,000 module and the $60 software download. So, yeah, you'll get some of both sides. Like, you'll get an enjoyable car. It can be kind of a time bomb. So it's almost like you have to be really vigilant about maintenance. You're going to want to make sure that you sort of keep up with it from the get-go. So I don't know. I don't know that it's a waste of money. You get a nice car. It can be sort of an entree into masochism. You'll end up drinking tea and hating yourself.
Hey, some of us, that's how we live.
I don't know. All right, so I'll do one more here. Nick A. from our George from our lovely state of Massachusetts. Maybe you know Nick. Maybe he's a buddy of yours.
Maybe.
He asks what the dumbest automotive mistake you've ever made is. He shares one where he left a spacer on when switching from his summer wheels to his winter wheels. So I'll share my dumbest automotive mistake. And that was trying to drive a car in a freak snowstorm with high performance summer tires on it.
Nice.
Yeah.
How'd that turn out for you?
I bought a transmission. So that was kind of dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. So,
all right. I had a 99 Tahoe, two-door Tahoe, up until like 2 winters ago, and it needed intake manifold gasket. I had to swap that out, and I was bolting the intake manifold back in, and I misread the torque spec by one decimal point.
Oh.
So I applied 10 times the amount of pressure required to bolt these bad boys down.
How many did you snap?
One of them. And no, I'm sorry, two. Two, because I was doing it with my buddy. We're like, what the hell's going on here? And we snapped two bolts off in the block, and we couldn't tap. Do the tap and die because the bolts were hardened steel. So we had to take a harder drill bit.
Also snapped off, right?
Yeah, we had to borrow somebody's, like, we went through a cobalt tip that just turned to mush. And then we used a diamond tip that ended up working. And so once you get that tip going, what you have to do is, it's like,
lubricate it.
Well, it's like you're drilling somebody's, it's like you're drilling a filling and you have like the suction cup thing, the suction hose there at the same time. You have to have a shop back hose pointed right at the hole we went in there with like a file.
Yeah, you got to clear out the swarf. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were cutting the bolt into quarters down the long way, pulling pieces out and bits out as it came out. And I don't think it went too
nice.
Well.
Nice.
Yeah. So, Steve, you don't have any?
No, I do. I thought of one that was really pretty good. When I lived in my very first apartment after I moved out of living with a friend for a while, I had a really long driveway that like went down around to the back of the house because it was an old house that was converted into apartments. And to get back out on the street, you had to drive down this long driveway. And then it was a very steep incline down to the street, and I was driving a Nissan Z, and so I didn't want to risk scraping the front of the car on the pavement as I went down it, and there wasn't a lot of room to go down on an angle, so I decided I was going to back out, and I backed all the way down the driveway, and I got to the edge I got to where the road was, and I thought I was completely on the driveway, and I went down on the curb and scraped the rear wheel, scraped the entire like sill of the car as I dragged the car down it. Ooh. And then scraped the front wheel as it went down as well.
Oh,
that was my shining moment.
That must have been an awkward phone call.
I drove it to the office. that was an awkward conversation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it happens. It's not, there are other guys that are just completely totaled cars. So,
that's honestly like one of the worst things that's happened. My other stories are just funny. They're like the time that I took a Jaguar XF home for the weekend when I lived down a mile of dirt road and had a huge dirt gravel driveway. And a freak snowstorm came and dumped 8 inches of snow on the ground, and I couldn't get the car out of my driveway.
Yeah.
Like, at all.
But that's a favor when that happens, because you shouldn't be on the road with the car. If you can't get it out of the driveway,
it
just saved you.
It was fun.
See, that's a safety system.
That is a safety
system. Active safety.
Rear-wheel drive cars with summer tires and a blizzard. That's a safety system.
It's good practice anyway.
When not in motion.
Yeah. So, all right, I think that's enough of the podcast for this week, unless you guys have anything to add.
Nope.
Here.
And of course not. So I will remind everyone that the Autoblog podcast is brought to you by the Tire Rack, the leading online source for tires and much more. Wheels, wheel covers, windshield wipers, engine and brake fluids, lighting and more. I was looking at their site today. You can get like performance upgrades. I'd love to talk actually brake pads with them. I'm sure that you guys are that excited about it as well, but I think there's a lot of stuff you can sort of poke around and come up with a very big wish list at the Tire Rack website. So you can check it out yourself at TireRack.com. And until next week, you know where to find us. You can drop us an email at podcast@autoblog.com. Let us know how we're doing in iTunes. Until next week, I am Dan. And it's George and Steve, and we'll see you next week.
Take care, guys.
Good night.